No, I mean, they're very integrated. In fact, some of the things I'm going to be talking about today show that what we hear is very much influenced by what we see. And right the way down in the basic physiological level of the auditory system, there's input coming in from the visual system. So the two senses are very much interrelated and interlinked. So it's what we hear, you shouldn't necessarily think about it as being dependent. That's kind of my message for this talk, actually, just on the sound waves entering the ear. It depends on a whole load more stuff, including visual information.
Well, look, do feel entirely free. I mean, seriously, and I'm sure Chris is very happy with this. If there's something you really want to question at the time, stick your hand up. And,
yeah, absolutely.
We'll get a mic to you. But there will be ample time for discussion at the end. And I think as the day goes on, the discussions will become more and more important in the run of things. But for the moment, let me hand you over to Chris Platt.
Right, thanks very much, Brian. Okay, so this is the boring title of my talk, Introduction to Auditory Perception. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how the ear works and tell you a little bit about the more psychological aspects to hearing sound. But my sort of preferred title, really, is The Joy of Hearing, which was going to be the title of my book, but the publishers have no sense of humor at all. Okay, so the auditory system doesn't just involve the ears, the external ear. In fact, this external ear, the pinna, doesn't really do very much for humans hearing. There's also the inner ear here and various structures. This is the brain stem at the top of the spinal cord, and you've got the auditory cortex, which is part of the cerebral cortex, tucked in there. So the auditory system is both the sort of basic mechanical or biomechanical and physiological mechanisms in the periphery, and also all the neural processing that analyzes the sound. And I'm just going to give you a sort of whirlwind tour of the auditory system, tell you how it basically works. So this is a cross-section of the skull showing the various parts of the peripheral auditory system. So this is the pinna, this is the cartilaginous bit that you hang your glasses on. As I say, it doesn't really do very much for humans, but it helps us localize sounds to a certain extent. We can use our two ears to tell where sound's coming from. So it's coming from over here, it'd be a bit louder in this ear than this ear, and it would arrive at this ear before this ear, and that helps us to judge the direction. The pinna really helps us with elevation. Sounds coming from different heights get bounced around differently in this bit, and that modifies the sound, and our brain's very clever, and they can detect those slight modifications and work out roughly the elevation of the sound. So sound waves travel down the ear canal, which is a sort of resonant tube, and impinge on the eardrum. Now these structures, the eardrum itself, is exquisitely sensitive to sound. You probably don't realize, I mean, sound waves are composed of pressure variations in some medium. Normally we think of it as being the air. And the quietest sound we can hear corresponds to a pressure that is a 1/5 billionth of atmospheric pressure. So this is equivalent to a wave 1 millimeter high on an ocean 5,000 kilometers deep, take a water analogy. And we can hear that those tiny, tiny, tiny pressure variations. The eardrum, when the eardrum is responding to a sound near the threshold of hearing, it's actually displacement is less than a tenth the width of a hydrogen atom. That is how amazingly fine-tuned and sensitive it is. So the sound waves enter here, they cause the eardrum to vibrate. These vibrations are carried by these three tiny bones, the smallest bones in the body, the ossicles, malleus, incus, and stapes, to the cochlea, which is a thin tube coiled up into the shape of a spiral, so almost like a snail shell shape. And it's within the cochlea that really all the action happens. That's where all the really clever stuff goes on, and where the sound, the acoustic vibrations in the cochlear fluid are converted into electrical impulses that travel up the auditory nerve to the brain. This bit here, this is part of the vestibular system that helps us with our balance. Okay, so if we have a look inside the cochlea, this is the spiral. We can do a cross-section of that and have a look in different compartments. You can see it's divided along the length of the tube. So you can think of this as being you can sort of imagine it sort of stretched down to a thin tube, divided along its length into three compartments, three fluid-filled compartments, by Ryson's membrane, which is very boring, we won't talk about, and the basilar membrane, which is very interesting, we will talk about. And sitting on top of the basilar membrane are the sensory cells, the hair cells, and these detect vibrations in the basilar membrane. Okay, so this is probably the most important fact to know about the way the auditory system works. When we see things, a visual representation in space, the photons from reflected off various objects are focused by the retina, and they form a spatial representation on the back of the retina, and that's carried on up the visual nervous system. What the auditory system does is to take the a sound entering the ear, and it splits it up into its different frequency components. So, for example, if you have a very bright sound, a crash of a cymbal, that's going to cause the excitation in the cochlea at the base of the cochlea, at the sort of bottom of this spiral, very low frequency sounds, sort of bass drum, bass guitar, whatever, that causes excitation at the apex, at the tip of this of the cochlear spiral. So now what we're doing now, we're looking down onto the cochlea, and this is, we sort of extracted out the basilar membrane. And it's the basilar membrane that separates out these different components. So the apex of the basilar membrane, this sort of top bit here, is thick and relatively loose, and it has a low resonant frequency. So that's tuned to fairly low frequencies, like that, or like this. Okay. And as we go round the basilar membrane, it becomes stiffer and lighter, and that means it has a higher resonant frequency, and then it's tuned to higher frequencies until we get right up to near the base of the cochlea. So each place on the basilar membrane is tuned, and it's tuned in a sort of similar way as you might tune a guitar, so that the bass strings are heavy and loose, they're low frequencies, that corresponds to the tip of the basilar membrane, and the high-frequency strings are light, and they're also quite stiff. They've got a lot of tension in them, and so they vibrate at a high frequency. And so the basilar membrane is tuned like that. So when sounds enter the cochlea, they cause vibration corresponding to the frequency components that are in the sound. So if you have a lot of high-frequency components, very bright, trebly sound, that will cause excitation at the base of the cochlea. If you have a very low, deep sound, that will cause excitation at the apex. The actual motion of the basilar membrane is a little bit more complicated than that sort of simple explanation I've just given. It actually forms this sort of rather interesting thing called a traveling wave, and this is just an example of this. So this is a grossly distorted view of the basilar membrane. In fact, it would be, relatively speaking, it would be much thinner than this, and these vibrations would be much, much smaller, but this just is an illustration. So when you have, for example, a high-frequency tone, it's causing excitation. You imagine the basilar membrane's been stretched out here at the base of the basilar membrane. So something like this. You get this sort of wave that looks something like this. For low-frequency tones, causing excitation at the apex, at the right-hand side here, where it's a bit thicker and looser. So the basilar membrane vibrates in response to sounds, but that isn't the whole story. It's not a simple passive system. If you had hearing impairment, then it would be a simple passive mechanical system, just tuned in the same way as a musical instrument might be tuned. But I get a bit of a compliment, that's rather nice. But the ear is actually much more sort of active than that. The healthy ear, and it needs to be in good healthy condition, even taking aspirin can mess it up enough to stop this working properly. The healthy ear has this active physiological mechanism, and it's mediated by these particular group of cells called the outer hair cells. So these guys here modify the vibration of the basilar membrane. These guys, the inner hair cells, they're responsible for converting the vibration into neural impulses. So the cells look a bit similar, but they actually have quite different functions. Now, what the outer hair cells do is quite amazing. If you get vibration at a given point on the basilar membrane, it's responding to a particular frequency in the sound. It might be a harmonic if it's a musical tone. They take the vibration at that particular point and they amplify it, but they only amplify it for the frequencies close to the frequency that it's tuned to, and that has the effect of really sharpening up the tuning, making it much more sensitive only to that narrow range of frequencies. And electron microscope picture of the hair cells. They're arranged in rows along the cochlea. So these are the outer hair cells here, and these are the inner hair cells, and these are the hairs, the stereocilia sitting on top. Now, the way the outer hair cells do this is using this thing called electromotility. So that when they respond to sound, when they respond to a movement of the basilar membrane, it's like they kick back. They actually change their length in time with the vibration of the basilar membrane. So it's like pushing a swing. If you push the swing at the right phase at the right time, then you're going to increase the vibration of the swing. And this is a real outer hair cell. This is a film of a real outer hair cell. Rather than being stimulated by sound, it's being stimulated by electric current. That electric current is derived from a well-known tune. So let's see if we can see the outer hair cell doing its stuff.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad bags on.
It's always a winner. So. So this is something, you know, I mean, you don't really think of cells doing that. I mean, this is quite kind of unique, really, having these cells responding, and they can respond at very, very high rates, you know, of 10,000 cycles per second in response to the sound, sort of giving that basal membrane an extra kick. And it gives a remarkable amount of gain. You can get up to about sort of 50 decibels of gain, which is a factor of 100,000 in terms of intensity. So if we have a look at the basal membrane, so what it's doing, if you get a sort of complex sound waveform entering the ear. Here's the basilar membrane. I've drawn it, just a sort of side view of the spiral. And you can imagine that different parts of the basilar membrane vibrate in response to different frequency components, so they separate out these different sinusoidal components, more or less, in the complex sound. And that really underlies everything we hear. So here is actually a sort of a model of what the cochlea is doing. And this is frequency along here. So you imagine different frequency components in sounds, which characterize particularly the different vowel sounds in speech and also things like different musical instruments. So this is a vowel sound. In fact, this is just the bar part of bar da. And this is time along this axis showing how the response is developing. And this shows the sort of pattern of activation that you get in the cochlea. So this is the bass responding to high frequencies and the apex responding to low frequencies. So the first few harmonics, vowel sounds are tuned, that's why we can sing, and periodic sounds have a series of harmonic frequency components of integer multiples times the repetition rate. Bore you too much of the details. But anyway, the auditory system can separate out. So these peaks here correspond to the first 10 or so harmonics. But the higher harmonics aren't separated out, but you get sort of these gross overall peaks corresponding to the interaction of several harmonics. Okay. So the auditory system, and this helps characterize different vowel sounds. So different vowel sounds are going to have different patterns of peaks. So when I go E, A, I, O, U, the difference you're hearing between those different vowel sounds is due to these spectral peaks. And that's why the auditory system uses this type of analysis, so it can identify sounds, so it can identify the different features that characterize sounds. So going back to, this is just another view of the organ of Corti in the cochlea, which has the different hair cells. So here are the outer hair cells I talked about. Here are the inner hair cells, and they're responsible for converting the vibrations of the basilar membrane into electrical impulses. And what happens is that as the basilar membrane goes up and down, you'll notice that the hairs, you can just see them here on the tops of the hair cells, they're bent from side to side, okay? You get that? So as the basilar membrane goes up and down, the stereocilia bend from side to side. And this is a real highly magnified view, electron microscope view, of the stereocilia of these hairs on the hair cell. And you notice that they're connected by these tiny, tiny protein filaments. And this is a real sort of Heath Robinson-style mechanical system, because attached to these so-called tip links are little trap doors. And when the hair cells bend, when the hairs bend in one direction, these trap doors open, and they let through these positively charged ions. So it's positive electric charge, and that enters the cell, and it causes the cell to become electrically charged, electrically active. And then when they bend in the other direction, the trapdoors close and the ions don't come in. So as the basilar membrane is going up and down, the hair cell is essentially being turned on and off repeatedly. And that's basically how the acoustic vibrations are converted into electrical activity. So you can imagine that here is the basilar membrane. It's moving up and down in response to the sound, and the stereocilia are getting bent backwards and forwards. Only when they're bent in this direction, away from the center of the cochlea, do you get an activation of the hair cell. And then the hair cell becomes active, it releases this chemical transmitter, that crosses this tiny gap between the hair cell and the auditory nerve fibre, and that causes nerve impulses in the auditory nerve. And because the activation of these hair cells is sort of time-locked to the stimulus, it only happens when you're at a particular point in the cycle. That means if you have a repeating sound wave, for example, something with a musical pitch, then you're going to get auditory nerve fibres which are synchronised, phase-locked to that firing. So a given auditory nerve fibre might not fire on every cycle, but it's going to fire at the same time of every cycle of the sound wave. So when you have a look at the response across many fibres, you can see that it reproduces, to some extent, the vibration of the basilar membrane. And this brings me on to my next topic, where I'm going to talk a little bit about how pitch is represented. Pitch is obviously very important, not just in music, it's also important in speech. It helps you get the intonation contour of speech. If I speak on a monotone, it is rather uninformative. But if I express myself, I can ask questions by changing the intonation, the pitch of my voice. Perhaps not so obviously, it also allows us to separate out different sounds. It's something I'll come along to later in terms of their different pitches. So basically, you can divide sounds into the ones that are periodic, that repeat over time, and these often are heard as having a particular pitch. They might sound something like this. Okay. And those that don't repeat, and these are heard as noise-like. Okay. So there's a very sort of clear perceptual difference between sounds that repeat over time, which are heard as having a pitch, and sounds that are noise-like. Now, I just told you about how in the cochlea, the vibrations of the basal membrane are converted into periodic or phase-locked patterns of neural impulses. So if you have a periodic sound, then that produces periodic firing in the auditory nerve, and in fact, right up in the early stages of the auditory system. So sounds with a low pitch will have a low, there'll be a sort of low period of neural firing. Sounds with a high pitch will have a high period of neural firing. And that is thought to be how we encode the pitch of sounds. And it's quite remarkable how sort of accurate this temporal coding is. So someone did an experiment once, I think it was on a guinea pig or something like that, where they put an electrode in their recording from the auditory nerve, and they just had someone speaking to the guinea pig. And they played back the recording of the auditory nerve, and you could actually understand the speech was perfectly intelligible just from the firing of the fibers, because they're representing quite well the activity in the cochlea, which is related to the sounds coming into the ear. So that's it just for the sort of peripheral auditory system. But as I say, after the ear is separated out the different frequency sounds and it's also encoded the temporal patterns of firing, it then has to go about sort of analysing these signals that are coming up the auditory nerve. And of course, there are lots of very, very complex processing centres in the brain that do that. And we're really only just beginning to sort of understand some of the things that are going on in the brain. A lot of, in the auditory system, which is unlike the visual system, a lot of the processing happens in the brainstem, which is just on top of the spinal cord, before we actually get to the sort of convoluted cerebral cortex. So you have all these different centres, like the cochlear nucleus and the superior olive, lateral lemniscus, and the inferior colliculus, all these centres, until finally it gets passed up to the medial geniculate nucleus, which is part of the thalamus, like a relay station, then onto the auditory cortex. And the if we're just focusing on pitch for a moment, this sort of synchronised firing proceeds all the way up the brainstem, up to about the level of the inferior colliculus. And you can actually record the neurons in human listeners. You can record them responding to this pitch. And it's one of the bits of research I'm involved in, is actually looking at how the brain represents the pitch of sounds. What sort of coding does it use for pitch? And you can do these experiments, which are types of EEG, electroencephalography, which basically involve putting electrodes on the head. And by positioning the electrodes in certain ways, you can record from different parts of the brain. This is a very simple EEG experiment, which is just fine for recording things in the brainstem, which just has just three electrodes here. But you can also do much more complicated electrode configurations here. If you want to record more the spatial activity of the brain, you can stick electrodes all over the head, but it's a bit more sort of time consuming. So for a lot of our stuff, we don't bother with that. And so here I'm sort of lying down, whoops, and the sound is being inserted into my ear via these tubes. So you don't have big headphones because they create huge electromagnetic fields that are picked up by the electrodes. And what do you get? Well, what you find is that you can record if you present a sound here which has is clear repeating, has a certain pitch, you can see the clear, regular phase-locking pattern of the neurons in the auditory system. So the temporal characteristics of the sound are very well represented in the upper brainstem. We're sort of fiddling around trying different stimuli and seeing how these are represented. The other experiments I'm involved in are to do with brain imaging. That's where you're actually looking at the spatial pattern, more at the spatial pattern of activity. And this uses a technique which involves a very, very large magnet, superconducting magnet, and some very, very sophisticated technology. And these are very expensive bits of kit, as you might imagine. They use them for medical scans. But someone worked out a way of actually finding out which parts of the brain were active using this sort of medical scanning technology. And basically, it measures the oxygenation of the blood. So a part of the brain that's very active, there's higher blood flow and there's more oxygen around. So you can measure that, and you can measure which parts of the brain are more active. Unlike EEG, which is very good at representing the temporal characteristics, fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, is very good at working out the spatial pattern of activity in the brain. So this is just an anatomical, this is actually my brain, just to prove that it's all there. So this is an anatomical scan. This is just a slice in that direction, a sagittal section. This shows the convolution of the cerebral cortex here. I was depressed to find it was no bigger than normal, but anyway. And then you have the cerebellum here. This is the brain stem I was telling you about. So this is where a lot of the sort of fundamental auditory processing goes on. What we're looking at in this particular experiment is where pitch is processed. And the way we did this was we played lots of sounds that produce a pitch. We compared them to a noise sound that had the same overall level and overall characteristics as the pitch sound. The only thing that was different was it didn't have a pitch. And then we found out which bits of the brain responded to the pitch sound but not to the noise sound. So those are the brain that are selective for pitch. And this just gives you an idea of the sort of activation patterns we can get. So this is a slice now in that direction through the head, and these are different. I won't bore you with the details, but these are just different types of pitch evoking sounds, slightly different characteristics. You can see they all cause this activation at the sort of posterior part of the auditory cortex, this region called the planum temporale, which is sort of quite high up the processing stream. And so what we're suggesting is that perhaps this is the place where you have lots of different things, you have different musical instruments producing pitches. They might produce the same pitch, but they have very different characteristics otherwise. But where does this all come together? So we have a region that's just responding to pitch sounds, and one possibility is that these activation patterns represent this region. Okay, so I've given you a quick tour of the auditory system. I've talked a little bit about pitch. I'm going to talk about some more sort of high-level processes, and particularly this thing called auditory scene analysis. Now, this is probably, the reason I'm sort of bringing this up is it's one of the most, it's one of the most important things that the higher-level processing tasks that the ear does, and it's also one of the hardest things that the ear does, one of the most difficult tasks. I mean, just sort of thinking about it, we're quite, you know, you're listening to my voice here. Obviously, there aren't very many competing sounds, apart from the occasional Muzak that's coming through. But in many sound environments, we have lots of different sounds coming. This is just a sort of trivial example. There might be sort of music coming from hi-fi. Someone might be speaking. There might be a sound of a car. All these sounds, they just add together in the air to produce this sort of unholy mess. And the question is, how on earth do we separate out these different sounds? We can do this quite easily. If you've got normal hearing, hearing impaired people often have difficulty with this particular task. But if you've got normal hearing, then we find it quite easy to separate out the sounds from these different sources. So how on earth do we do this? Well, the simple question is we don't know exactly yet, but we know the sorts of things that are going on. And a lot of these are quite sort of old ideas, go back to the Gestalt, so-called Gestalt, Gestalt meaning whole, psychologists in Germany in the 1930s. And they had some sort of principles or rule of thumb. And these apply both to vision and hearing, so that similarities that parts belong to the same object tend to be similar. They tend to be similar, for example, in pitch. Good continuation, parts belong to the same object tend to vary smoothly together in time. I'll give you some examples of this. And parts belong to the same object tend to be close together. So I'm speaking, all the sounds from my voice come from a particular location in space. So let's have a look at some examples of this. Before I get onto that, the Gestaltprobleme that work, basically as they describe the nature, their descriptions of the nature of reality is the way it works. If I'm producing speech, you're not likely to get that many parts of my voice coming from different directions. There will be certain amounts of reflection, but most of it is coming from my mouth. And similarly, when I speak, I tend to speak on relatively stable pitch. It goes up and down a bit, the intonation, but this similarity works quite well. So for a lot of the sounds we hear, obviously we can synthesize sounds completely break these rules, but most of the sounds we hear, these rules roughly apply. So the senses are using implicit knowledge about the way the world works to narrow down the possible ways of sorting out all these sounds. In some sort of alien environment where the normal physical rules didn't apply, we'd be completely lost because we wouldn't be able to interpret the pattern of sound waves coming into our ears in this way. So just to give you a couple of examples. Sounds that produce a similar pitch tend to group together. This is two melodies. I'm just going to turn down the volume a little bit because this is quite loud. This is two melodies that are interleaved, and then what's going to happen is that one of the melodies is going to be pulled apart from the other melody. And I want to try and identify the lower of the two melodies. And you'll see as they get progressively pulled apart, it becomes easier to do. So they're gradually being pulled apart now in pitch. Everybody get that? So that's Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. When it was embedded with those other notes, because they were similar in pitch, you were lost. But when they got pulled apart, you could separate them out. And that's how we kind of can follow individual instruments or indeed a given speaker at a party or something like that, by following their voice pitch. Okay, sorry. The other thing, I mentioned the idea of proximity. Sounds from different locations. Our ears are quite good at localizing sound, not nearly as good as the visual system. localizing visual objects, but we're quite good at localizing sounds using our two ears. And so if you have, say, an orchestra, you can actually you can follow individual instruments partly by sort of concentrating or focusing your attention on one particular location. Let's see how we're doing here. Okay. So good continuation, that was another Gestalt principle I mentioned. In terms of the auditory system, what we're saying with good continuation is that sounds from a single source tend to flow smoothly. You don't get abrupt discontinuities. And this helps us to follow those sounds over time. Musical melodies, for example, they tend to, although the pitch obviously does vary, it tends to vary over relatively small musical intervals, and we can follow that melody. And some of the Baroque composers used this to actually get a single monophonic instrument, say like a flute, to play two melody lines by having one melody line in a very low register, one in a high register, and alternating the two of them. And that would separate out those two streams. But generally, a sound from a given source, if it does change, it changes smoothly as the articulators in my mouth change the sounds that are coming out of my vocal tract, for example. It does a smooth, it has smooth effects on the frequency composition of the speech that's coming out. This is just an illustration of this. This is a spectrogram which shows a plot of frequency against time along this axis. This curve here, the big red curve, shows the variation of the voice pitch or fundamental frequency. And as you can see, as I'm saying this sentence, I'm going to die, which is a question. you can see the voice pitch rises at the end, but it does so in a smooth way. And because these changes are happening smoothly, we can sort of track them over time. So if you have two melodies, that even though they might be separated by big pitch, if you glide between the notes, it helps to fuse them together. So that's another way in which the auditory system helps you can try and sort of group together those sounds from a particular source. The other nice thing that the ear does, and this is kind of like, I suppose it, you could regard it as an illusion, really. It allows us to perceptually complete sounds or to fill in the gaps when a sound is interrupted. So if I'm speaking, someone slams a door, and that might obscure parts of my speech. We often can't recognize which part of the speech is being obscured because the brain automatically sort of compensates and fills in the gaps. And there's some good examples of this. I've just got a couple here. So this is a tone that's gliding up and down, but there are gaps in it, so you hear discontinuities, hopefully. I'll just turn up the volume a little bit. I'm not sure, the acoustics of the room might not be good enough for that. Did people hear a discontinuity? Some people at the front might. I'm not so sure about the people at the back. I'm sorry about that. So now I'm going to play exactly the same sound, but in those gaps in the sound, I'm going to present bursts of noise. And they're going to, and the ear is going to think, there's something interrupting this sound. And it's going to think, well, that sound is probably interrupting something that's continuous because that's the way the world works. And so it's going to fill in the gaps. So what you should hear when I put the noise in is you should hear now, even though the tone isn't really continuous, you should get the illusion that it is continuous. Okay. And you can do even sort of cleverer things where you can have, as you sound like that warbling up and down, you can sort of cut out several warbles and you hear the warbles continuing in the noise even though they're not actually there. So it's just another example why you shouldn't trust your ears. And here is an example of speech where we've done a similar thing. We've sort of broken it up. And so this is the original.
Auditory signals involve grouping sound. The principle of similarity is very important.
Okay. That's actually Al Bregman talking, who came up with the idea of auditory signal analysis, more or less. And here is the same thing. And now I'm doing the same trick, exactly the same speech sound. There's nothing, no speech has been added, but I'm just going to fill in the gaps in the speech with noise.
Auditory signals involve grouping sounds. The principle of similarity is very important.
So you hear a natural speech that's been interrupted there. You don't hear those discontinuities anymore. And in fact, tests have shown that it's more intelligible, the speech, when you listen to it with these noise bands, than when you just have the gaps in there, which is really quite a sort of interesting thing. You're actually adding something that isn't giving you any new information. In fact, it's some noisy stuff that's probably obscuring a bit of the speech, but it helps you to hear it. Now, this is another example that may or may not work. If it works, it's great. I'm going to try it anyway. And this is, we talked about how this is sort of the general sort of point I'm going to try and finish on here, is that a lot of what we hear or think we hear is constructed by the brain. It isn't actually necessarily in the sounds that are entering our ears. We think that when we hear something, when we experience sound, that we're hearing what's out there, but a lot of what we're actually hearing comes from our own sort of interpolation, as in those previous examples, but also from other senses and from our sort of memory and experience and the rest of it. Now, here's an example from vision. This is an illusion called the McGurk illusion or McGurk effect. What I want you to do, this is an example of how we use lip reading. So what I want you to do is to look at this this fellow here and just concentrate on his lips, okay, and listen to the sound and then think about what you're hearing, okay? So just look very closely at his lips.
Ba 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 ba.
So da da.
Ba ba.
Everybody hear da da?
Ba 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 ba.
Okay.
Ba 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 ba. Ba ba.
Okay, now try closing
ba,
your eyes.
Ba,
just close your
ba,
eyes now.
Ba 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 ba.
Open them.
Ba 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 ba.
Okay.
Ba.
So, some of you got that. Some of you didn't. What these actually, the lip movements are actually for the utterance ga. There's a sort of continuum ga. Da, ba, in terms of where the closure occurs. You can think about this if you do ba. Because we're a sort of, when you listen to the sound, the lip movements there don't correspond actually to the sound. The sound is bar, 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 bar. That's all that's being played. But because the lip movements sort of guard each other in the continuum, the brain sort of interpolates and hears da, da, which is halfway in between. So the lip movements are actually influencing what you hear, but you get a very strong impression, at least you know, in a controlled environment, that you're actually hearing this thing. It's in the sound. It's not something you're putting together. And so you really shouldn't necessarily trust your ears in that respect. What you hear is influenced quite strongly by what you see. And just to finish off, let's have a look how we're going for time. Yeah, that should be all right. So we talked about the way the ear fills in sounds. When there are lots of sounds going on, it can interpolate sounds. It sort of constructs. We talked about visual cues. But, of course, there are lots of other things going on. And our perception of a soundscape, of the sound environment, of all these different sound sources that might be around us, the meanings and emotions that it evokes, they depend on many different factors, not just the acoustic stimuli themselves. So we might have a busy, crowded street where you get sort of footsteps, maybe buskers, cars, whatever. The thing that we actually hear depends, for a start, on expectation, what we're expecting to hear in a given environment. If it's very incongruous, for example, if you hear the sound of a train going through here, it would change the way you reacted to that sound and to your emotional response. So expectation is important. The activity you're involved in at the time is very important to how you respond, particularly emotionally, to the sound. If you're looking for a relaxing time, you don't want to be on Oxford Street. But if you want the sort of hustle and bustle, and that's the sort of thing that gets you going, then maybe you would want to be on Oxford Street. The familiarity of the sounds makes a big difference. Obviously, this is particularly true with emotions. The sound is a very powerful creator of emotional feeling, and we often have sort of our tune sorts of thing, pieces of music or sounds of particular people that evoke powerful emotions. So familiarity and memory are very important. The visual context, as we've just seen, has a great effect on what we think we're hearing. What we're attending to in the scene, there's a general rule, this is also a Gestalt idea, that in any given environment, perceptual environment, there are two types of stimulus, essentially. There's a thing that we're attending to, which hopefully is me at the moment, and there's everything else, which gets put together in the background. It's called figure and ground. So we can change our perceptions of a soundscape. You can think about this if you're listening to a piece of music, you can focus on the drums, you can focus on the bass guitar or whatever. So what we're attending to makes a big difference to what we're hearing. And, of course, the emotional state in which we're examining. You know, if we're in a very fragile emotional state, we might not want to hear someone crying, but it might not be so bad in other conditions. So all these things combine together, and they influence our experience of the auditory world. So this is my sort of final message, that hearing is essentially a full-brain experience. It doesn't just depend on the sounds entering our ears. And I think I'm going to end at that point. So thank you very much.